Welcome to Authors First on the Artists First World Radio Network, artistsfirst.com. Tony Kay in the studio. Thanks for joining us, everyone worldwide. We're so proud to introduce our guest this hour, author Jonathan Maxwell. He's coming to us from somewhere in Alabama, and he's studying at Jacksonville State University, finishing his Master's of English, but more importantly than his love of literature, our guest, Jonathan Maxwell, has written two fabulous books, German Elites and the Nazi SS. His first book, already has received the 2011 All Books Review Editor's Choice Award in the category of Best Nonfiction Book. Congratulations, Jonathan Maxwell. In addition, he's written another book, which we're going to talk about, but Author Exposure rated his work 20 Most Memorable Debut Books of 2010. Wow. Wow, serious writing here, folks. You're going to love our guest, Jonathan Maxwell, joining Tony Kay on the Artist First Radio Network. His second book, Plit Down, Men and Other Hoaxes, a lighthearted examination of the scientific frauds through history, such as the Minnesota Iceman hoax. Wow, we're going to have fun. That sounds fascinating. Check out the website. No, just go to Amazon.com and buy Jonathan Maxwell's book right now. Buy both of them because they're absolutely fabulous. You're going to love the books and our author this hour. You know what? He likes to talk. He's been on Blog Talk Radio or has a show over there. Maybe he'll have a show over here someday. You never know. Jonathan Maxwell, thank you for being our guest on Artist First Radio. How you doing over there?
I'm fine. And you?
Did I completely humiliate you yet?
No, that's fine.
Okay, then thank you, okay, for accepting that. Moving on, Jonathan. Wow, two incredibly different books under your belt now. One of a serious and a historical nature, and the other of a, I guess, more of a pseudo-scientific approach. Are we learning something about Jonathan Maxwell?
Well, to tell you the truth, as much as I enjoyed, you know, researching and writing my first book, the subject matter was just, you know, it is such a heavy subject. And I wanted to take on a project that was, you know, a little less gloomy, you know, something that was more emotionally, you know, easy to work through. And I'd always had an interest in scientific hoaxes, you know, even as a small child. You know, I grew up reading books about Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster and the Abominable Snowman, you know, what have you. Those books, you know, just fascinated me as a boy. And I figured, you know, for my second project, why don't I write about those subjects? And I had a lot of fun, you know, doing the research, although quite unintentionally, I actually ran into some very heady themes, you know, in the second book as well. You know, the subjects that I touch upon, even though many of these events happened, you know, decades ago, you know, we're still arguing about the same things. You know, we still argue about the conflict between religious tradition and evolution, and science and innovation versus, you know, tradition. And, you know, we still talk about, you know, race even today. So compared to my first book, yeah, it was lighthearted, but I still touched upon some serious themes that I think people will find, you know, very thought-provoking.
Did you develop criteria? I mean, come on, this is a big subject. Or you could devote a whole book to one hoax.
Sure. I think more than anything, I wanted to provide some sort of insights into the psychological makeup of the hoaxer and, you know, the people who fall for these hoaxes, you know, time and time again, you know, which was, you know, generally the subject of my first book. Even though the themes are different, you know, I still want to examine the psychological mindset of the characters that I present in my books.
Jonathan Maxwell enjoys majoring in his minor. I caught that right away, Jonathan.
Yeah, thank you.
And congratulations on your academic selections and putting it to good use by writing such quality literature. Thank you for that. Reading, writing, boy, I'm glad you said that right up front.
Oh, yeah.
Today,
yeah,
it was television.
It drove me.
Oh, my. The computer, cable, I mean, it's in some instances, I think, starves creativity. Reading, though, builds creativity.
Yeah, well, I guess it depends on what you watch. You know, I'm not completely cynical about television.
But you are a cynic.
Unfortunately, yes. And,
yeah.
And that's sort of the approach that I took with my book. It's funny because when I first started reading about these subjects, you know, as a boy, I was just caught up in the excitement of it all. But writing from it, you know, from an adult perspective, you know, it's much, much different. I don't argue that, you know, none of these things exist. What I am saying is that we have to, you know, approach all this from a scientific viewpoint, because we can't just believe everything that we want to believe. There has to be some sort of objectivity there. And, you know, even though a lot of people laugh about these subjects, you know, Bigfoot and the Yeti and all that, I mean, irrationality can be really ugly sometimes. It was irrationality that brought on, you know, the witch trials in Europe and in the early United States. You know, they believed in witches back then, and, you know, they accused people of being witches, and some were burned in the stake for that. So, you know, irrationality, you know, it can have some really, really unforeseen problems and some serious problems as well.
And your research would, depending on which case you're studying, which hoax is being perpetrated, might lead you in multiple areas of research.
Oh, sure, absolutely, yeah.
It is a scientific endeavor. I mean, you are looking for information from multiple sources to collaborate, confirm, deny, assess a situation.
Yeah. And unfortunately, you know, a lot of the true believers, you know, unfortunately, they're not doing that. They're not following up. They're not being realistic. You know, I think they're being a little too, you know, accepting. I think that the Bigfoot hoax, more than the others, I think that best illustrates the points that I'm trying to make. There are so many true believers of Bigfoot, you know, out there. But if you actually look at the evidence, the evidence just, you know, isn't really there. There have been reports of Bigfoot, you know, going on 200 years. A lot of people simply believe in Bigfoot because, you know, certain Indian tribes believed in Bigfoot. They believed in a man of the woods. The thing is that there are many, many mythical legendary figures in Indian mythology, and just as there are in, you know, Greek mythology or what have you, but that does not make the creatures, you know, factual. And, you know, scientists have found very, very little physical evidence for the existence of the creature. There's never been any, you know, Bigfoot bones found, you know, hairs that have been, you know, very decisive in displaying, you know, what it was. The plaster casts of the footprints, most of those have been dismissed as fakes and not even, you know, clever fakes. And finally, you know, there's never been a Bigfoot captured. And when you look at the paltry amount of evidence, I think you have to be a little bit cynic about the entire, you know, Bigfoot affair. And I realize that a lot of people don't want to hear that, but, you know, unfortunately, you know, that seems to be the truth of the matter. Given all the, you know, the searches, extensive searches, you know, all the theorizing, I think by now we should be able to have something, you know, even if it's just an old skull. But, you know, we found, you know, again, the evidence has been very, very paltry. It's been very, very unsatisfying.
Well, by the title of your book, did Piltdown Man begin this journey for you, or did you discover the bone fragment theory and of connecting to humans as something later on in this search for hoaxes?
The book sort of, you know, evolved. Originally, you know, it was just going to be one of the many hoaxes that I discussed. It was just, you know, later on during the project when I decided to make the Piltdown Man hoax, you know, to focus, you know, very, very extensively on that. And I think that's just because of the scientific importance of it. When the Piltdown Man hoax was, you know, proven to be a hoax, it nearly destroyed, you know, the entire scientific discipline of paleoanthropology, that being the study of human origins. You know, it just almost destroyed it because Piltdown Man had been more or less declared by the European scientific community as being the first man. And then, you know, recently discovered dating techniques revealed that the jaw came from a simple orangutan, and the cranium came from, you know, a thoroughly modern human being. They were just painted brown with ordinary paint to make them look very, very old. Given such a humiliating, you know, scandal, a humiliating hoax, paleoanthropology just lost almost all of its credibility, and it really forced science as a whole to take a look at itself. I think one of the major things about the Piltdown Man hoax was just the fact that the scientific community looked bad. So often scientists warn others about losing their objectivity and their excitement. But this time it was a scientist who had lost their objectivity. So I just found it just an amazing story, a very, very interesting story.
And lots of important documents existed to discuss this, as you stated. I mean, there was analysis at from lots of scientific points of view.
Yeah. And one problem was the creationists, the religious fundamentalists who had always believed that human beings were created in their present form about 4,000 years ago. When the hoax was announced, the creationists just immediately began telling everybody, you know, since Piltdown Man was proven to be a fraud, that means evolution as a whole, you know, must be a fraud. And so to them, Piltdown Man, they believed that it proved them in the right, and they still do that. Even though a lot of people now aren't so familiar with the Piltdown Man hoax, the Missing Link hoax, people, you know, have just grown up believing that, you know, evolution is wrong just because so many creationists said it was wrong. And they just said that, you know, they had proof to, you know, to confirm their suspicions. And so, you know, it reverberates, you know, even today.
You are living in Alabama. Jonathan Maxwell, our author, our guest. Culturally, in this country, there are influences that permeate a culture for many generations.
Sure.
In your first book, with the Nazis and the SS, that was a serious historical work. And the method that was used to make the intellectual community welcome or accept or turn a blind eye to activities that the SS and Nazi regime were conducting, or under the guise of science, the Holocaust and so forth. All of that type of information about that you researched, in other words, do you think you applied the same skill toward the hoax?
I certainly think so. I tried to be as objective, you know, as I could, and I tried to be respectful of all parties, particularly the creationist. I think it's pretty evident that I side with the evolutionist. You know, I think that's pretty, you know, apparent in the book.
I think that most Christians do too.
yeah. But
I think it's a very narrow, I think it's a small cross-section of those who live with perhaps with the King James Version of translation and have been taught and believe that that is the only purpose of the word. So, you know, but a larger community would accept the fact that we have evolved over many, many hundreds of thousands of years.
Sure.
The debate goes back further as to first cause, which is another way of looking at the Big Bang. Was there an intelligence behind where we are today? That's a whole nother topic. But with hoaxes, how do they begin? Either deliberately, somewhat, as in this case, evidence has been tampered with, created to give the image appearance of being ancient when it wasn't.
Sure.
Okay. In another case, it's a personal experience of that ghost in the dark, that sound, that knock on the window that tells me that I'm not alone when it was just a bird that hit the window. So, you know, deciding hoax, now that was a very concrete item to look at first, pit down man. Give us something else from the book, something maybe that was a little more mysterious or individually, you know, oriented.
Yeah. Crop circles.
Crop circles. That's a good one. Yeah.
That's really interesting because, you know, people started reporting these crop circles in the 1960s, the 1970s, and there was widespread speculation about what they were. And, you know, there were a lot of really, really strange theories, you know, about how they came about. Occultists believe that, you know, Satanists gathered around these circles to call up Satan or some other demons. And also, many believers in UFOs believe that, you know, it was some sort of signals, guideposts of a sort, or, you know, residue from, you know, where the UFOs were resting. You know,
yes, they traveled across the universe using sophisticated technology that allowed them to bend space and time and to arrive here only to have to put on a crop circle to know where they're at or where they're going.
Yeah, I know.
I'm a flying saucer. I'm an advanced species, and I got to look down at the earth to see this monument down here as a message.
Oh, sure.
Well, now let's write it in the language no one can understand. How's that?
Yeah. And here's the thing. Hoaxers began coming forward to admit that, you know, they were behind the hoaxes. You know, they would just go in at night, and they would produce these circles by using primitive farm equipment. And, you know, that should have ended the matter, but, you know, it didn't. The true believers out there, they still cling to their contentions. And the more that you try to argue with them that, you know, this was just a simple hoax, the more they claim that there's some sort of a government conspiracy going on, that, you know, their conjectures still stand. You know, even to this day, they're still asserting that there's, you know, more going on. And that tells you right there a lot of the psychological mindset of these people who repeatedly fall for these, you know, outrageous frauds. For some reason, they find reality, day-to-day reality, too mundane, too unexciting, too uninspired, too regimented. They're just very, very unsatisfied with daily life, so they're always looking for something, mysterious and freakish and strange. In a way, they're very similar to drug addicts in the fact that they're always looking for some sort of, escapism. And if it's not crop circles and it's alien abductions, it's...
Don't go there yet now. Let's talk about the crop circle one more thing.
Yeah, go ahead.
What about, are there individuals coming forward who say, yes... Well, we were standing here on the roadside. We suddenly noticed that these crop circles were forming. Yes, we saw they were forming just out of the blue, or this unidentified object from the sky was creating them, or the wind began to spiral erratically, and it was like poetry. Or no, there were people, and they were out stomping around. Yeah. Anybody see that? Who's that person? Did you find any of those?
And it's interesting, you know, in regards to the people who, you know, insist that they're
witnesses. I saw it happening. There it was.
But you know, they never seem to have any proof. You don't see photographs, you don't see, film. When you do, you know, it's obviously very, very fake. On the Daily Show, I believe that's the show on Comedy Central, they were featuring a so-called scientist who... his doctorate actually came from a diploma mill that shows you a lot about these so-called scientists. But he offered proof that there were, flying dinosaurs left in Australia or New Zealand, and he offered photographs.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah, and, you know,
flying dinosaurs. I love it.
Yeah, the photographs were taken at night, and you couldn't see a thing. I mean, absolutely nothing. And you see that problem, you know, time and time again. These so-called witnesses, they don't generally provide any sort of proof. Anybody can say that they've seen, you know, crop circles being formed. But if you want to convince people, you have to offer some sort of proof, and that would be, you know, film or photographs. And sadly,
is that proof?
It can be, but generally with the photographs that we see or the film that we see, it's just, you know, obviously a fake. In the past 3 or 4 years, this actually happened in North Georgia. two men had declared that they had actually shot a Bigfoot.
And, I remember. They were all over the place. Yeah, they were going to, it was going to be a big show, and they were going to bring out the bot. I think they, didn't they lock it up in a freezer?
And they posted you know, because of public demand, they uploaded a video showing the dead creature. And, you know, it was obviously a gorilla suit, you know, just obvious. And that's generally the way these things work. You know,
well, if it wasn't, then why aren't we still talking about it, number one?
Sure.
Number two, why hasn't the scientific community come out and said, yeah, that's the hair, that's the blood, that's the skull, that's the thing, yeah. But they don't.
No.
They haven't, and they won't.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's not.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, that seems to be the case. And I tell you, what's really sad these days is that, you know, on TV now, you have these documentary-style programs. You know, I think there's three or four of them, you know, about, you know, searching for Bigfoot. And you have these expeditions, and the people behind these expeditions, you know, they're so confident.
They ought to be selling, Jonathan, they ought to be selling a lot of those night vision goggles.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, in spite of all their hopes and, you know, as hard as they work, you know, they find nothing. You know, absolutely nothing. It's a lot of people laugh about it, but it's actually sad in a kind of way because so many people, they pin all their hopes and dreams on these things that, you know, probably do not even exist. There's a touch of sadness in all of this once you really think about it.
Well, don't feel bad because, Jonathan, we have the longest Bigfoot show on planet Earth. The most continuous Bigfoot Central on the Artist First Radio Network got started in 96.
Sure. Oh, yeah, I'm familiar with it.
And we've had everybody and their brother on. It's just been a blast.
Yeah.
A blast. But you're right. What we offer on television is so superficial. I would hope that those truly interested in a topic, whether it's posed as a hoax or not, or the verdict's not out yet, will spend some intellectual energy pursuing that topic to their satisfaction and then move on to something else, okay? As Jonathan Maxwell, our guest, has done so succinctly, and thank you so much for touching on, as we said, audience, at the beginning of Authors First, any one of these topics, Bigfoot, crop circles, UFOs, my God, there you could write volumes on what's been said and done and on an ongoing basis, just trying to keep up with the internet. Just put it in.
Oh, sure.
Go
yeah.
up there and zap it in there and see what comes up. It's just you can't keep up. But nonetheless, fascinating subjects, not proven scientifically as we would measure or value information, as Jonathan Maxwell has pointed out. And so, yes, a critic, good, because we need to have some intelligence behind looking at these different topics. So, Jonathan, thank you for putting it together. What age group do you think your book reaches? Are young people going to find this an interesting read?
Oh, I certainly think so. I wrote the book, you know, in part because I wanted to write a book that that young people could read and could find, you know, fascinating.
And a little witty, too. I mean, not so dry or historically factual as your first book, as you stated. Pit Down Man and Other Hoaxes, Simple Folks. Just go up Amazon.com, and you'll see a photograph of our guest, Jonathan Maxwell, a bio that I don't need to read, and, of course, quality material that you can trust at affordable price. If you love to read, if you're interested in the topic, you have to add this to your library. If you're into hoaxes at all, or you're interested in the topics of Bigfoot or UFOs or crop circles or the Piltdown Man, he's done a wonderful job putting it together in a very readable form. And I would say 13, 14 age up if they have a vocabulary or if they have an interest in expanding their vocabulary. What's wrong with looking up a few words? Come on, let's stretch a little bit, okay? Jonathan Maxwell helps us do that by offering a little bit of a cynical or critical evaluation to the topic. So, and some humor, too, because after all, we have to laugh at ourselves, you know, the things that we get involved with. So, Jonathan, exciting. And you're doing other things. You're not, you know, you love to write, and you're working on something else, too.
Oh, yeah. I actually have a couple of manuscripts going on. You know, one is about the tragedy at Altamont. That's where the Rolling Stones put on a free concert in San Francisco in 1969.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah,
and see, that ties in with Artie Kornfeld, the father of the 1969 Woodstock, who has radio show on our network every Tuesday night. Artie is on live all the time and brings these people from the 60s and 70s. Okay, 1969, cool, way cool. And that's a different. Now, are you an artist? Do you enjoy music?
I enjoy music. As for musical talent, I have none. But, you know, I certainly enjoy music.
Well, that's just great. What brought you to that topic in that concert? Were you there?
Oh, no. I'm still very much a young guy. Oh, okay. I wasn't even born then, but I've always had an interest in the hippie movement.
I could have been there, though.
Oh, really? Yeah. It was probably good that that you weren't, because the Rolling Stones, they made the terrible decision to hire the Hells Angels to provide security.
Oh, and yeah, the, great guys.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The problem was that the Rolling Stones were very familiar with the British Hells Angels, who were actually much, much milder. In England at the time, they were much like hippies. They just rode motorcycles. Here in the United States, and they didn't know this at the time, but the Hells Angels in America can often mean,
civil unrest, violence against authority, rebellion against the elite.
Murder, drug dealing, what have you, and four people wind up dead, in part because of the security, and they immediately waged war against the hippies, and they started beating up on hundreds of them. The members of Jefferson Airplane were attacked. The performers were assaulted as well. One of them was actually knocked out, if you can believe that. And the Hells Angels also sold heroin and cocaine to the concert goers. So there were, literally hundreds and hundreds of drug overdoses. And just because of, this disaster, a lot of social, theorists say that Altamont was really the end of the spirit of the 1960s. That, along with the Charles Manson murders. And why was I drawn to that subject? I love the Rolling Stones. I love, reading about counterculture, and I was just drawn to it. I just write books about subjects that really, really interest me.
Where was the National Guard when you need them? Well, they were here in Ohio at Kent State University.
Unfortunately.
Oh, well, there you go. So you got the Hells Angels of California, but you got the Ohio National Guard at Kent State University. Hey, you talk about social unrest.
Yeah, yeah.
It was all happening at one time. right on the, of course, right on the heels of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy and the marches in, well, that's right, Alabama.
Oh, sure. Yeah, it was a very, very turbulent period. And it being so turbulent, it was, you know, also fascinating. I'm sure it was a lot different from people who were actually living, you know, during those times.
A great topic for an author, see, because you can you have the moment of time, which is that stage, that event, that happening, and then from it you have this wellspring of cursory other social activities going on coast to coast, or reaching back a little ways a few years before the concert, and then that all merges together. What a wonderful concept for a book. You have to be having fun. Now, how long does it take you to look at a topic and decide, you know, this is going in, this is going out, this is long, this is short? There's a process that's happening. Do you have a sense of where you're going to end up, or does the material just evolve and sort of write itself as you explore?
Well, I can't speak for all authors, but for me, it just sort of evolved. That was certainly the case with my first book. When I first started on that project, I was going to focus on, like, 10 Nazi figures who I thought were excellent examples of the murderous intellectuals. But I found so many murderous intellectuals that while writing the book, I just suddenly realized that to concentrate on like 10 figures, you know, that wouldn't do the subject, you know, justice. So, yeah, as far as writing a book, for me, it's really just, you know, one day at a time. And, you know, there's going to be some times when you slip off into tangents. And some of those survive, some of them don't. And sometimes you, you know, radically, you know, change directions. But that might seem, you know, disorganized, and maybe to a point that's true. I think that Piltdown Manor of the Hoax, it just kind of meanders a little bit. But sometimes that's not a bad thing. Sometimes, you know, that gives the book freshness. And so even though I think with my second book it kind of meanders a little bit, but it's still fresh because you don't really know, you know, where the book is going to take you.
German Elites and the Nazi SS defines a period and social change very much as the book you're working on with the Rolling Stones.
Oh, sure. And again, these are just topics that have always fascinated me.
Well, of course, it's Jonathan Maxwell. This is your heart and soul, what the things that interest you from a psychological or historical or sociological point of view. It's not that you are a strict scientist, but you have interest in the scientific process. So what a wonderful gift you're giving in your books.
Oh, thank you.
And thank you for sharing with our audience what it takes to go into this topic and really do justice and write a book that's been recognized, awarded, and congratulations for that.
Oh, thank you.
With the German Elites and the Nazi SS, have you found an audience perhaps with Jewish organizations or those who support the historicity of the Nazi movement and the Holocaust? In other words, you have sort of a targeted demographic here of people who would be still interested in that subject, even academics, universities, and those who teach the topic.
I was really lucky with that book in that you know, it actually attracted a very, very diverse audience. Yes, there were many Jews who took, you know, a special interest in the book, but Army, well, military veterans, they really took an interest. Young people, very excited to say, a lot of young people found it to be an interesting topic, you know, because they're learning about these events, you know, in high school or, you know, in college, you know, some for the first time. And strangely enough, I found a lot of appreciation in the black community, which I thought was strange for a while, but then I realized that blacks and Jews, they really actually have very, very similar histories, you know, the same history of you know, enslavement and persecution and the loss of you know, civil liberties. So the book was you know, I'm excited to say that it actually attracted a very, very, you know, diverse audience. I was able to speak in front of, you know, military veterans and high school students and college students. And it was just, you know, a very wonderful experience, particularly to be accepted by, you know, so many different kinds of people.
Jonathan Axwell, thank you for your literary contributions and for being so articulate, getting out there in front of the people. I have interviewed a lot of authors, of course, over the years, and getting an author out of that shell that is pretty typical of being a writer and articulating your ideas and concepts in front of an audience, so important to get out there and meet people and express yourself and hopefully sell some books too.
Oh, sure. Well, you know, the promotion and marketing of the book, that's every bit as important as, you know, actually writing it. You know, that's, you know, that's one aspect of your career that you have to place a lot of focus on. You know, your publisher wants you to sell books, and you do too. You know, you don't want your book just to sit on the shelves. And to do that, you have to promote your book. Now, you know, how you promote your book, you know, to a considerable extent, that's up to you. I decided to take a very diverse approach. Radio interviews primarily, but I also did a few television interviews. You know, I conducted interviews, you know, in the newspapers and literary magazines. You can speak in front of groups, you know, the Civitans, the Kiwanis, Mensa. There's a lot of groups that, you know, like to attract speakers to their meetings. Or if you want, you can, you know, send out your send out copies of your book to you know, critics who will, you know, review your books. There are many ways to promote your books, and you know, however you want to promote the book, you know, it is up to you. But at the same time, some sort of approach needs to, you know, you have to promote the book somehow.
I like giving a few away myself. I think if you know that Colonel Powell or Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama, our president, would enjoy a topic or subject, that you find a way to get it to them, you know.
Oh, sure, yeah, absolutely.
You know, and that, or a famous personality, perhaps, or an actor, actress that's performed a particular movie that would be of that genre of interest. I think that sometimes authors forget that it's okay to invest a little. You've invested all of this time and money and research getting to this point. Oh, well, give away 10 books and autograph them and make sure they go out to 10 people who would really profit and benefit from the content and be able to help you promote it.
Oh, yeah,
and
sure.
That could be the New York Times, okay, and trying to get on the list. You don't know. Addressing it to someone who would actually read it because they have an interest in that topic.
Oh, sure.
You know,
sure.
If they have 100 people on staff, you know, make sure you send it to the right 100th of a person.
Oh, sure, absolutely. But, you know, the important thing to remember is you have to promote the book. Since you took all the time in writing it and researching for it, you want your book to sell. Again, the worst thing that can happen to an author is to have books that just sit on a shelf and are never read. They're meant to be read. And, the way to get the book read, the way to get it out there is to, promote and market the book as much as possible. And it's funny, a lot of these first-time authors, they sort of look at these engagements or responsibilities with dread or with horror, because a lot of authors, they are very shy people. But I've learned that it can be, exhilarating experience. You can have a lot of fun, and you can meet a lot of great people, while you are marketing the book.
Well, and of course, those who value literature know, hey, I'll spend $15, $25 because this is a topic that I'm interested in.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
And that's where it's all moving. I think that's why most of the bookstores, the mom and pop, certainly are almost gone, because people locate their topic of interest on the internet and click, click. They don't know you from Adam, but you're covering a topic they are interested in, and boom, you have a sale.
Sure.
So, the internet has changed everything for authors. And this venue, being able to broadcast and get your voice heard by hundreds of thousands of people, Jonathan Maxwell, on our network is just unbelievable compared to even 15 years ago.
Oh, sure. Yeah, the internet has really, really changed society, including hoaxes. You would think that the internet... people's ideas and thoughts, they would each progress along with one another. But it's strange because the internet has just provided another venue for hoaxers to get their word out.
Question everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Verify everything.
Yeah, I'm thinking that because of the internet, hoaxes are never been, so common. You think that progressiveness and technology goes hand in hand with one another, but that's not the case. The internet has been absolutely the hoaxer's dream, and even if you put out a video that's obviously completely fake and bogus, you can still achieve easily your 15 minutes of fame. Which is what happened to those two guys that filmed made the film in Georgia. Certainly, they got their 15 minutes of fame. They probably got more than 15 minutes.
Did they go on with a TV series, I thought, for a while, or maybe one season? I don't know. I can't keep track. But you're right. There's just so much bogus information out there, people. Be careful. Do your research. Check it out. Don't be so gullible or easily led by the nose to believe everything that you hear or experience on this earth. Come on. It's the information highway. We're being bombarded. How do we cross-check and know that the information is accurate? Well, Jonathan Maxwell, thank you for spending this time on Authors First. It's been my privilege to introduce you to our worldwide audience, and thank you so much for supporting the arts on artistfirst.com. Tony Kay in the studio, questions, comments, they're always welcome. Send them to dj@artistfirst.com. And, of course, we invite you, our listeners, to share Jonathan Maxwell's information and his books on all of your social network sites, Facebook, and so forth. So have a good time with the broadcast. They're available in MP3 format and free on demand. Jonathan, before I let you go, anyone out there on planet Earth you'd like to say hello to, or any closing remarks?
As for closing remarks... you know, when it comes to these mysteries, I hope that I am wrong. I hope to be wrong for being a skeptic, because I would love for, you know, a lot of these legendary creatures or mysteries to be real. But, you know, it's okay to have hope, but you have to be realistic as well. And that's what I'm trying to ask people to do. Just don't go into anything blindly.
Bye.